Hello, soccer fans. This is Dave Hodges. Thank you so much for tuning in to the next great soccer show. Got a great show lined up for you today. Going to be talking with football author Matt Guy, based out of Southampton over in England. He's got a new book out. It's entitled Barcelona to Bucky Thistle. Got him on the line now. Matt, hello. Can you hear me?
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for agreeing to be on the show. I know we've been talking back and forth for the past couple of weeks, and glad to finally be talking to you. How about just giving a little backstory on yourself to start the program?
Sure. I've sort of written three books now, all about sort of football on the sort of fringes, so sort of as far away from sort of mainstream, sort of Premier League, Champions League, you know, as possible, because I think that's where the sort of the real heart and soul of football lies. So I started in 2014 as a reaction to my local team Salisbury going bust and sort of disappearing, and I realised how fragile sort of football clubs, small community clubs are, and I wanted to sort of like celebrate them and explore them more. So I started writing, and now I'm three books in.
The first book I purchased of yours, Minnows United, I know it came out a couple of years ago, Adventures at the Fringes of the Beautiful Game. Of course, you can find all of your books on Amazon.com. Just look for author Matt with one T, Guy, last name spelled G-U-Y. So you're drawn to the much smaller leagues and, as you say, where really the soul of the game lies. When did you realize that that was where your passion for the game was?
I think it's always been there. When I was very lucky, when I was a young boy, I sort of lived close enough to Southampton, who were at the time in the old First Division playing against like the legendary sort of teams from Liverpool and whatnot. So I had that on my doorstep. And I also went to visit my granddad in Salisbury a lot, and they were playing part-time football in the Southern League, and sort of one Saturday I go to Southampton, the next Saturday I go to Salisbury. So I've never differentiated between the big teams and the small teams. I found them the passion and just the skill and the intrigue and excitement. I've never differentiated one between the other. So I think I've always had that mindset that the small time is worth persevering with and exploring. So I think I didn't stand a chance really. My granddad sort of made sure that I was as big a Salisbury fan as anyone else made me a Southampton fan.
What's it like? I mean, just the difference going, say, to First Division, now the Premier League side, to a lower level is obviously, you know, you go from the big stadiums to the smaller ones. What's the passion like with the fans? Obviously, I know it's raw passion over there in the United Kingdom. Talk about the difference between obviously like the upper league and the lower leagues.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you're right. It's a religion, and that's sort of sort of bandied about sort of quite flippantly, but it is. It's people's entire lives. And I'm guessing maybe it's a similar sort of thing is like sort of baseball in America, which I think has very sort of similar sort of connotations with sort of passion and being sort of completely enthralled. And it doesn't matter where you go, whether you go to a Premier League match, a match in League Two, a match in the sort of the non-leagues, which are sort of the leagues below the four main professional leagues. And you see the same thing. You see passionate fans that will travel week in, week out, home and away, spend their hard-earned money, taking time off midweek to go to these games. You know, it's just because they're smaller, the passion between Liverpool and a non-league team or Accrington Stanley is one of the teams that sort of very romantic sort of named team in the lower divisions of England. And, you know, you can go to watch Accrington Stanley play against a team like sort of Rochdale. We can see Liverpool play Manchester City, and the passion's the same. It's literally just the size of the community that supports them and the number of fans, but you will not see any difference in passion. Just, you know, the crowds are smaller, so the songs are not quite as loud, but it's, yeah, it really is, no matter how far low down you go, the passion is front and center.
Being here in Charlotte, North Carolina, I myself, we have a lower league team here, the United Soccer League Championship. We have the Charlotte Independents, and we just were awarded before Christmas an MLS franchise in 2021. And I identify with a lower league side, and I do agree with you. There is a lot of passion there. The team is still growing, the fan base. I believe this will be the Independents. I want to say sixth season coming up. I could be wrong, but I definitely agree with you that, you know, it has so much more of a community feeling. You get to know the fans, you know their story, where they develop their love of the game. Of course, obviously, it's going to be a little bit different, learning it here in the States, where soccer is still gaining momentum. Is there that real sense of community over there in England?
Yeah, I think it can't be understated how sort of like football clubs bind communities together. And, you know, in parts of Britain, sort of like industry has collapsed, and sort of like traditional sort of what would be your traditional working base has been decimated by, sort of just modernization, sort of mining and stuff shutting down. And often what used to be like just one, the football club used to be one part of that community, and now it's often all that's left. And the football club sort of binds communities together, and communities bind the football club together, and one wouldn't exist without the other. And, and it's a lot of these institutions, these small little clubs, you'd think there's no way they can survive, but they survive through the belligerence and perseverance of the communities that care for them. And no matter where you go, you'll see like families, young girls, young boys, going along on their own. It's kind of like it's where people go, and that's what I'm trying to celebrate, because at the moment you sort of see a lot of sort of supporters just switching to watching football on the television, and while that's fine, you get to see the best players in the world in your front room, you don't get that community feel, you don't get that feeling of belonging that you get when you're actually physically part of something. And I think that's what makes football so special all around the world. With your team, with teams that have existed for like 150 years, it's like it's the same thing that drives mm-hmm. them. It's just some teams have had longer to sort of bed into a community than others, but they're no less important and they're no less significant and vital to keeping individuals, communities sort of like together and enthused and positive.
That's really one thing I enjoy about having a USL championship side here, which is, I guess, one rung below Major League Soccer, is the players are so ingrained in the community. And after every game, they'll come over, talk to the fans, take pictures, autographs. And I've even gotten a few autographs from the players myself. And to see how these young kids react when they meet their favorites, it really does connect to the community like no other sport in the world does.
Yeah, that's right. I remember growing up, I grew up in a time when sort of like even footballers at the very top of the game didn't earn vast sums of money. So you would grow up and there would be a professional footballer potentially living on your street. It's not now the sort of the very top players, they live in sort of gated mansions, far, far away from the right. communities. But, further down the leagues, that still exists. You have players that, they live in and amongst the people that come and watch them play and their friends. And especially clubs like Accrington Stanley, you see that. You see young lads get into the youth team and all their friends come and see them watching the youth team. And then they get into the first team. And, you see like this, just this genuine connection between the people on the terraces and people on the pitch, because they're one and the same. Just one's more blessed with footballing talent than another. But, they're neither is more important to the club. It's, the fans and the players are equal. And and that's good to see that it's happening in America as well. That, you know, it's just the players respecting the fans and the fans respecting the players and the club. It's what it's all about. And there seems to be quite a significant disconnect between the Premier League over in England and, you know, the players and the supporters, because the supporters don't get to see the players anymore. You know, that they're not available. They don't live in their communities, and that's, you know, it's a sad reality of it becoming one of the biggest sporting sort of franchises in the world now. You know, it's a monster, but in becoming that big, it also loses something, and that's what I try and explore, is just that feeling, you know, that I used to have when I was a boy, and were non Premier League supporters will have that connection sort of week in, week out. It's definitely what football is meant for. It's what it's all about, and what the point of football is to bind people together, identity, meaning, and an outlet for passion and sporting endeavor.
Talking with football author Matt Guy here on The Next Great Soccer Show. Now, in your book, Minnows United, Chapter 2, you talked about football in Palestine. And the title of the chapter was If Football Shirts Could Talk. And shirts were donated really to this war-torn part of the world. What was it like being in all these places and talking to these people?
Yeah, it's been a privilege to actually sort of meet people through football from different walks of life, different cultures and whatnot. And it's always humbling. And no matter the language barrier, football always finds a way of, you know, you always could communicate through football. That the one in Palestine I met, the premise is that, you know, this kit went off to the Palestinian under-15 team in Gaza, and because of the language barrier was pretty poor at the time. This was like early 2002, something like that. We didn't sort of stay in touch too much because, of course, they were struggling. They didn't have too much in the way of sort of internet or indeed electricity at the time because of all the sort of intifadas and whatnot. So I sort of lost touch with them. But I just, after about sort of 10, 15 years, I thought I really want to know the people behind these pictures I got of these kids wearing these football shirts. And I sort of went on a little journey to try and find the people and find out what became of them, which was quite an overpowering emotional story. In meeting one of the players, you know, it's just amazing, this connection that football binds people together, no matter their political leanings, no matter their religious beliefs, and you know, it's just football is a different, it's its own thing, and it can bridge so many potential barriers that, you know, a lot of other things can't bridge. So it was truly humbling to meet Mahmoud, who was a Palestinian player, and I've met sort of Tibetans and Bhutanese players, and been sort of all around Europe and a few dotted around the world, and it's always just truly humbling to speak to people in the language of football.
So you mentioned a few moments ago about the club Accrington Stanley, and that chapter also really stood out to me as sort of the football club that just wouldn't die. From what was written in the chapter, it seemed like this club had everything against them, and somehow they just keep on persevering.
Yeah, they are. They're a perfect example of what sort of lower league, non-league football anywhere in the world, actually. You know, they're literally sort of half an hour's drive from Manchester United, Manchester City. They're about 50 minutes drive from Liverpool and Everton. They have sort of like Burnley are just like 10 minutes down the road. You know, there's so many reasons why football fans could go anywhere else, but they don't, because Accrington Stanley are from their community. And, you know, there's like a 1,200, 1,300 supporters who sort of support them through thick and thin, day in, day out. and somehow they managed to survive on that. And you know, they sort of beg, borrow, steal to keep going, and they've got like a new owner who's ploughed some money in. Before that, it literally was like him, you know, paying the bills in order so as the lights stay on. You know, it is truly inspirational how just pure love and passion can keep something going. It's and that's what lower league football is like. You know, it's there's no money there, so it's people just doing it purely for the love of it, and they don't get anything in return other than a sense of sort of belonging and a sense of doing something good for their community.
Your new book, Barcelona to Bucky Thistle, also available on Amazon.com. In chapter two, you talk about like the Faroe Islands, Azerbaijan, Kosovo, and really, it's what do you believe it's like for these much smaller nations going up against the giants, say the Spains, the Portugals, and England? What was it like talking to some of them?
Yeah, it's funny. Some of the players I spoke to, Odmar Faro, who's the centre back for the Faroe Islands, and he was saying that, you know, it's intimidating to go to these big places, but this is what these guys do it for. They love it. And he told me a story about his first sort of start international football was marking Mesut Ozil. And this was the Germany team who were in the World Cup qualifiers. They went on to win that World Cup and won it quite comfortably. And he was just talking about how, you know, they were struggling to keep contain them. But it was just, you know, the opportunity to pit your wits against the world's best. And this, at the time, this was like the best 11 players on the planet by a long stretch. And they said it's like it's a privilege. And I think the way they battle and the way they sort of, I've never seen, you know, I've seen England play a lot, and, you know, you see the World Cup matches and stuff, but watching the Faroe Islands play, they fight for every inch of pitch. They fight for every ball, and it's because it's so important to them to represent their country. And, you know, to them, you know, international football is playing against Kosovo and playing against Azerbaijan. And on the odd occasion, they get to play against the world's best. But it really is the feeling and the sort of the passion. It doesn't matter whether it's Argentina versus England or Faroe Islands versus Kosovo. You know, it means so much to those players and to the supporters. And, it's amazing, that the wonderful sort of quirk of World Cup qualification and European Championship qualification is that, yeah, you will get Andorra against Portugal or San Marino against Belgium, and you see like sort of part-time players playing against the very best the world has to offer, and it's and long may it continue, because it's what binds us all together. The fact that, you know, your part-time postman can be posting letters one day and the next day be playing against Ronaldo or trying to mark Messi, and it's mm-hmm. that's the magic of international football, especially in the qualifying stages.
Any funny stories from these players, like any nervousness that comes up, say like when they see the draw and they know who they're going to be going up against?
Yeah, there's it was Odmar from the Faroes was telling me this quite funny story of, you know, they all know what to expect, especially when they go away from home, because they know that, you know, that they're literally going into the lion's den and they'll be playing in front of, you know, a partisan crowd, you know, at the Bernabeu or, you know, Bayern Munich's ground. You know, it's like, you know, these are intimidating places to go, I imagine, if you're the away team. But you know, I think they really embrace that, and they see it as a great challenge and something they'll remember forever. But the thing that made me laugh was him talking about when teams come to the Faroes, and he said that, you know, no one's really prepared for how wild and rugged the Faroes is. And they said that you can see when the players step off the plane and to transfer onto a bus, you can see all these players suddenly sort of developing little niggles because they're suddenly thinking, I'm not up for this. I don't want to play on a volcanic island in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean that's storm-tossed. And one of the guys, quite funny. He was a part-time bus driver, and his job, as well as being like a centre forward for the Faroe Islands, he was a bus driver, and it was his job to actually take the opposition to the hotels. So, you know, all these like Ronaldo and all this lot on their buses had no idea that they had, you know, the guy that was driving them was actually going to be facing them the following day or following 2 days. And he used to say it was just such a buzz to hear them talking on the bus and saying how, you know, how they're going to smash them. And it's just such great motivation that he went in and told the rest of the Faroes players, you know, they're going to score like 9 goals against us. And having, you know that sort of like Italy went there as they were world champions and scraped a 2-1 win. Scotland drawn there a couple of times, and it's like they raise their game when they hear that these players think that they can actually smash them. So I found that quite funny that, you know, their biggest scout is actually the bloke on the bus.
What are the conditions like in some of these smaller nations? You mentioned like some that have volcanoes that just dot the location. I would think that would almost make conditions somewhat unbearable to play in.
Yeah, you would think that football and life couldn't survive there or thrive there, but it does. You know, a lot of the pitches are artificial turf because the grass simply can't survive the winter. So it's especially like in Iceland now, nearly all the pitches have been converted to artificial grass, and the Faroes, there's only a few that are still grass pitches because they just literally the grass will die, and it's you know, unless you sort of reseed it every single summer and try and get it up to scratch, you know, it's virtually impossible. So it's just passion that keeps it going. Life shouldn't survive there, let alone football. But they're so into their football, and they're so into they'll make it work no matter what happens. So yeah, you see these guys playing. I saw a recent training video of an Icelandic team, and it was a blizzard conditions, and they just sort of pulled their hoodies up and got on with it, and it was just like, you know, it couldn't happen anywhere else. It really couldn't. But the more extreme the environment, the more sort of determined they are to play the game.
Do a lot of these smaller nations, like saying when they're playing in the League of Nations against these giants, they kind of have something to owe to Iceland? Of course, we know Iceland's run in the 2016 Euros. That's kind of put the minnows on the map, so to speak, where a lot of these announcers or the pundits might think that, say, like the Faroe Islands, where they would believe that they could upset Spain. I mean, of course, any team can be beaten on any given day. Do you think Iceland's kind of put that tag on some of these lesser nations when playing in these European tournaments?
Yeah, I think they're the latest prototype in how to overcome, great obstacles. Because I think, you know, their pool of professional, sort of senior professional footballers that they can pick from is like 120. I think there's 120 senior professional football players that are Icelandic. So it's a tiny pool of players to pick from, and yet they managed to create squads that, you know, get to the World Cup, got to the European Championships, and humiliated England, nearly knocked out France. And it is that they're the prototype for how to do it, which is, you know, good indoor training facilities if you can't train outdoors, emphasis on good coaching, you know, playing, helping the youth, and really sort of investing in youth talent and pushing them forward. And, you know, even the Faroe Islands, their national team now, they're no pushover at all. And, you know, they've got an even smaller pool of players to pick from than Iceland, so maybe they'll never make the World Cup or what have you. But, you know, they just want to be competitive, and they want to be able to show their country in a good light. And no matter all the small nations, no matter the scoreline, that's exactly what they do.
Talking with football author Matt Guy here on the Next Great Soccer Show. One story I've tried to follow, bringing it back to England here for a minute, I've tried to follow as much as I can. Has there been any new news on Bury Football Club? We know the team has pretty much gone under. What are you hearing over there in England about the club?
Yeah, I think this is a very, very sad story. It's you know, it's kind of it warns of what happens when, you know, too much money at the top of the game and people are sort of striving to climb up the pyramid. They're basically the club as is, I think, are finished. I know it's technically they're not done. I think at the moment it's a case of people trying to sell off assets. So if someone will buy the stadium, then a sort of Phoenix club may be able to come along and start again at the very bottom of the football pyramid in sort of almost the amateur leagues. And it's been done before. Wimbledon, Aldershot. There's a couple of teams that actually literally started playing were professional teams, then had to start as in sort of village leagues, and have got themselves back into the football league or the very top end of the non-league. And I think for Bury, sadly, that's what's going to happen. They're going to have to start again from scratch if they can keep hold of their stadium, and someone, you know, benefactor will come in and buy the stadium for them. Then they've got a really good chance of shooting up through the leagues very quickly. But I know they wanted a special dispensation to sort of be put back in at sort of like the conference level, which is the league below the four professional football leagues divisions. But I don't see how they can. The Football Association can't set a precedent there, because a lot of teams that have gone bust before had to start from the very beginning. So sadly, I think, you know, this very proud club will literally have to start again as a Phoenix club, playing, you know, in local park football, and have to work their way back up.
It really is a sad story. I mean, as you mentioned, how soccer for people, you know, some walks of life, it is a religion, and I can't imagine, say, you know, a gentleman that lives over there, maybe 80 some years old, has followed the club his entire life. And to some people, their clubs are their identity. And now with the club being gone, and I'm sure that they've never thought about supporting any other club. I mean, they may say, you know, watch a few matches on television, but as far as going to the match, buying the jerseys, I don't think I could do it if, you know, say I was a senior citizen over there in the United Kingdom, followed one, you know, like I said, one club my entire life. And there's no way you could just say, like, hit the switch to support another club.
No, that's it. I mean, it genuinely is a bereavement. And it sounds silly when you're talking about a football, you know, like a sporting institution. But, you know, these clubs, I mean, Bury, I think, was like 134 years old, I think, when the beginning of this season. You know, it's like generation upon generation upon generation of families have gone, stood on the same spot on the terraces or the same seats in the stand, you know, going back, 70, 80 years. You know, you can physically trace this back directly through, you know, people sort of stood outside Bury's ground talking about, you know, what they're going to do next. And yeah, you're right. You can't just switch allegiances and become a diehard Rochdale fan or a diehard Bolton fan or something. You know, that doesn't happen. So they may go to watch just the game as a neutral, but that passion, you know, dies with the club. And unless they can sort of bring a Phoenix club up, you know, maybe some people will stick to that. Maybe others will just can't face it. And for them, you know, football dies when their team dies.
It really is a sad story because, like we talked about, with the smaller clubs that are so ingrained in the community that when those clubs die, like on Saturdays, people just don't know what to do with themselves, really.
Yeah, and it's tragic. I think Bury's debt is what actually made them go under was a relatively small amount of money that they just literally couldn't pay to like the tax man. I think someone said it was like, you know, it was the equivalent of like Messi, one day's wages for Messi was the money that
wow
did for an entire football club. You know, so just all that history was gone, and I think it was like £70,000 or something. They couldn't pay a tax bill, and that was it. Because it was literally just, you know, if you can't pay that, that's it. You can't move forward. And so yeah, it was in the scheme of things, in sort of the grander footballing scheme of things, it was absolutely pennies that caused them to go under. But for a club of that size, with very little sponsorship, a few thousand diehard fans, you know, £70,000, you just don't suddenly find that overnight. You know, it doesn't happen. So, yeah, it was absolutely tragic, and you really do feel for them, and it's not a position you'd want anyone else to be in who was like a mad passionate football fan or sports fan of any kind, because it's you just invest so much time and emotion into it, and for it just to be pulled from you, it's just unbearable.
Talking with football author Matt Guy here on the Next Great Soccer Show. Matt, one final question before we let you go. Any new books in the works?
Yeah, I've got an inkling. I haven't told my wife this because I promised her that I wouldn't do anything for a little while. But I've seen lots of like really interesting cup games across the world, and I'm sort of really like the idea of sort of writing a book on sort of obscure football cup matches or cup competitions around the world. And it was inspired by I didn't realise, but the French version of the FA Cup, or their cup competition, features all the sort of the principalities around the world, or sort of like the parts of the old mm-hmm. French Empire. So it's sort of like Reunion Island, Tahiti, these countries. Their league clubs can take part in the French Cup. So you have like a team from Reunion or Tahiti having to take like a 10,000-mile trip to an away fixture to play in this cup game against a French team. And it just sounds like a bonkers situation, but they do it every year, and just to be part of the bigger French, you know, the French Cup competition. And it sounds crazy, and it sounds like something I want to get look into. So I'm going to try and find similarly crazy cup institutions around the world and try and check them out and see what I can come up with.
Well, Matt, I can tell you, as a diehard fan and a fan of cup competitions, yeah, try to say that fast five times. I will definitely be looking forward to that book. And fans, you heard it here first, right here on the Next Great Soccer Show. Matt, thank you so much, and thank you for your time. Hope to talk to you again sometime on a future broadcast.
Thank you, Matt. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Matt. Well, that's basically the interview right there. What I'll do is,
go on.
I'm going to. I have a production computer. I have a background in radio, so I'm kind of trying to start a little freelance like voiceover business and whatnot. So okay. I'm going to be. I have, like I said, I have the computer with audio editing equipment. So what I will do is, I'll edit this down. I'll start on it this afternoon. I'll probably get to you sometime next week. I'm actually going out of town tomorrow morning, going with the fiance to Virginia. Got to help her mother move. Oh, as I've been joking with her, I said, "Well, I'll let you guys move, and I'll go upstairs and take a nap." So
yeah, absolutely.
But I might take my computer with me. I haven't decided yet. I'm not sure how much time I'm going to have, because we're going to be staying at her sister-in-law's house, and they have four dogs. So my time might be taken up. But yeah, I'm also going to add this just hit me. I'm going to add a little vocal bit to the end of the interview, just saying, where you can follow yourself on Twitter, and you can find your books on Amazon. So, I will definitely do that. And I'll hit you up on Twitter. And when I'm done with the editing and everything, I'll send you the interview. If like say you want to put on some of your social media, you can do so.
Excellent.
Okay. All right. Well, Matt, thank you so much. I know we've been talking back and forth, and I appreciate your patience with me.
That's a good one.
So, I'm enjoying the books. I'm actually still reading Barcelona to Bucky Thistle. So,
okay.
They are. I do enjoy them. And actually, really because of Minnows United, I really look forward to the ESPN Plus app, especially when the FA Cup is going on. They have a lot of the lower teams, like the Rochdales or Bristol City. And I will tune into those, say, before like a Juventus-Inter Milan match. So, your books have definitely, made me take a much lower or much – to take a look at the lower leagues of
Thanks,
of world football.
Good to hear.
Of European football, and actually, I've never written a book myself, but we have a cup competition over here in the States called the Lamar Hunt U.S. Open Cup, and that's something I would love to write on. So, or you know, maybe give you an idea, you know, of, you know, maybe something you want to do in the future.
Yeah,
because
there's such a market over here.
Oh yeah. I don't know if you know who Lamar Hunt is. He's actually the owner, or he's the late owner of the Kansas City Chiefs, you know, the American football team. And he was instrumental in getting Major League Soccer established here in America. I think it was back in '96. And the cup competition itself dates back to, I believe, 1914. For what he's done with soccer in the United States, they attached his name to it. And actually, as I mentioned, my Charlotte Independence, for the past 2 years, we have lost out to amateur sites.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, a team basically, you know, one rung below MLS. Yeah, last year we lost to the Florida Soccer Soldiers, an amateur side in Southern Florida. And actually one of their guys that scored two goals against us, we ended up signing him, and now he's playing for us. But I was actually on vacation with the fiance and her family. We were down at on the South Carolina beach, and it was a penalty shootout to see who advanced. And our last penalty, their goalie blocked it.
Right.
And of course they would lose the next week, but yeah, it's so much more fun at the fringes of the game, you know, kind of how your book puts it. But all right, Matt, well, I'll let you go. It's a pleasure talking with you. And like I said, I'll be in touch in the next few days. And once I get the interview edited, I will send it over to you.
Cool. Cheers, buddy. Thank you for that. Okay.
Thanks so much, Matt. And I'll talk to you later. Have a good day.
And you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.